This is joint work with Dmitry Pelinovsky and Tsipia Kukhanya. We have been studying the linearized operator L equals to JH, where J is a sigma 3 Pauli matrix, 1 minus 1 on the diagonal of diagonal 0, and H is the energy operator. Minus Laplacian plus omega plus f of x, g of x, and minus Laplacian plus omega plus f of x. The goal of this work was to establish the connection between the spectrum of the operator L itself and the spectrum of the energy operator H. It's very easy to see that operator L is not self-adjoint because J and H do not commute. But of course, energy operator H is self-adjoint. Operator L appears when we linearize the nonlinear Schrödinger equation I psi with respect to t minus Laplacian psi plus u of x psi plus f psi squared psi on the soliton solution. So when we linearize the NLS on the soliton solution, we obtain this non-self-adjoint operator L. F and G, actually, this is a bit late. There is explicit expression for F and G. F and G are exponentially decaying C-infinity functions, and they have explicit expression through the potential U of X and nonlinearity. Yes, yeah, we'll show a bit later. So F and G are exponentially decaying and C-infinity functions. We consider the problem in R3. Omega is the frequency of the acceleration of the soliton. It is positive. And spectral problem for the operator L is on L2 and C2 vector functions have two complex valued components. Okay. If soliton solution psi is phi of x to the power I omega t. Soliton is oscillating with frequency omega, and phi of x is a C infinity exponential decaying function. It satisfies the following elliptic equation, which we obtain if we plug the soliton solution into the NLS. If soliton phi of x is positive, then it's called the ground state. And if phi of x is sine indefinite, this is called the excited state. We linearize the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with the following ansatz. Phi of x, I e to the power omega t is our soliton, and perturbations are phi small of x e to the power minus I z t plus theta conjugate of x e to the power I z conjugate t, where phi and theta are small perturbations. So psi vector in the eigenvalue problem consists of these two components, phi and theta. And linearization and neglecting higher order terms yields to our spectral problem for our non-self-adjoint operator L. And as you can see, we have precise expression for our functions F and G, which are involved in the energy operator. They are U of x potential plus nonlinearity F of phi squared plus F prime phi squared phi squared. And G of x is F prime of phi squared phi squared. We linearize with the ansatz e to the power minus I z t, the solution behaves like e to the power imaginary part of z t. Therefore, there are three cases. First case is unstable eigenvalues when imaginary part of z is positive. So solution is exponentially growing. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. we have eigenvalues to be neutrally stable if imaginary part of Z is zero, and stable if imaginary part of Z is negative. So here we have unstable eigenvalues, imaginary part of Z positive, neutrally stable line on the real line, and stable when imaginary part of Z is negative. In the work, potential U of X is supposed to be C infinity, exponentially decreasing, and F C infinity and F at zero equal to zero, so that we have nice behavior for our function F and G. H is our energy operator, and the energy functional is considered on the space H1, which is and energy functional is the quadratic form of the energy operator on the eigenvector. For the operator L, linearized operator, the continuous spectrum consists of two parts. One part is from omega to plus infinity, and another part from minus omega to minus infinity. In this current work, we assume that ends of the continuous spectrum, point omega and minus omega, are neither resonances nor eigenvalues of the operator. If we have resonance and eigenvalue at the ends of the continuous spectrum, this case was investigated in the recent work of Sipio Kukani and Dmitry Pelenovsky. The linearized operator L has a kernel C0, which is phi of x minus phi of x, where phi is our soliton, and it has the generalized eigenvector phi 1, which is minus d phi d omega d phi d omega, where d phi d omega is the derivative of our soliton function with respect to the frequency omega. So we have that L acting on phi 0 is 0, and for the generalized eigenvector, L phi 1 is equal to phi 0. In this work, we made the assumption that kernel of our operator consists of only one element phi 0, no any other elements, and generalized kernel consists of two elements, phi 0 and phi 1. The case when generalized kernel has high algebraic multiplicity was studied in the recent work of Andrew Komich and Dmitry Pelenovsky. Translational. Yeah, there's a potential, that's right. That's right, there's a potential. Mm-hmm. One more assumption we made is that there are no real eigenvalues with zero energy. In principle, there can be zero eigenvalues there can be eigenvalues with zero energy lying on the real line. We exclude this case in this work, and the case when we have real eigenvalues with zero energy, this work is in progress. There are symmetries concerning the eigenvalues of our linearized operator L. If we have a complex eigenvalue lying in the, say, first open in this open quadrant, then Z complex conjugate is also the eigenvalue minus Z, and minus Z conjugate is also the eigenvalue. If we have an imaginary eigenvalue, then Z conjugate is also the eigenvalue. And if we have a real eigenvalue, then Z then minus Z is also the eigenvalue. And real eigenvalues can be embedded in the continuous spectrum in general. We call the negative index of the operator H in L2, NH, the number of negative eigenvalues of the operator H. And if the operator of energy is restricted to the subspace X of L2 with the orthogonal projection, then the negative index will be just a number of negative eigenvalues of the operator H on this subspace. The adjoint operator is obviously L star is JH star is just H J, where J is our third Pauli matrix. It immediately follows that kernel of the adjoint operator is Phi-Zero Star, where Phi-Zero Star is just Phi-Zero original kernel multiplied by the third Pauli matrix. And one generalized eigenvector, Phi-1 Star, we get if we multiply the original generalized eigenvector by the matrix Phi-3. So we know everything about the structure of the generalized generalized kernel of the adjoint operator. So there was a work of Grilaki, Shatai, and Strauss where they showed that with a given assumption on the kernel of our linearized operator and generalized kernel, suppose Q of omega is a square of L2 norm of our soliton. Then, with our assumptions, derivative Q with respect to omega is not zero. Otherwise, it's possible to show that there will be more generalized eigenvectors. We go to the constraint subspace, where we orthogonalize our vector functions to the elements of the generalized kernel. We orthogonalize to Phi-0 star, which is the kernel of the adjoint operator, and to Phi-1 star, which is a generalized eigenvector for the kernel of the adjoint operator. Then it turns out that negative index on this constraint subspace X0 will be reduced by 1 if derivative Q prime omega is positive, and will not change if Q prime of omega is negative. In the present work, we do the same thing for all other eigenvalues of our general of our linearized operator L. So, as I mentioned, we assume that there are no real eigenvalues with a zero energy. Then, real eigenvalues consist of two parts: real eigenvalues with positive energy and real eigenvalues with negative energy. Then what we do is we orthogonalize to the eigenvectors of the adjoint operator with the same eigenvalues. And then what turns out is that on the continuous spectrum, after all these orthogonalizations, this negative index will be reduced by two number of real eigenvalues with negative energy, number of imaginary eigenvalues, and minus two number of complex eigenvalues. Actually, the way we count eigenvalues is the following, that imaginary eigenvalues and imaginary are imaginary eigenvalues with positive imaginary part. Because if there is here eigenvalue, then there is symmetrically, there is one more eigenvalue. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's actually, and for real eigenvalues, if there is a real eigenvalues z, then there is minus z. And number of real eigenvalues are real eigenvalues which lie on the half axis from 0 to plus infinity. And number of complex eigenvalues are number of complex eigenvalues lying in this octant with positive and positive real and imaginary part, because there is whole of really four eigenvalues. Using method of wave operators, Scipio Cucani proved that on the continuous spectrum, the energy operator is strictly positive. Therefore, negative index of the operator H on the continuous spectrum is equal to zero. And therefore, this implies the identity for the connection between negative index of the operator H and distribution of eigenvalues. Number of imaginary eigenvalues plus two number of complex eigenvalues plus two number of real eigenvalues with negative energy equals to negative index of H minus 1 if Q prime omega is positive, and 0 if Q prime omega is negative, where Q omega is square of the L2 norm of our soliton. This is our main result about connection between distribution of eigenvalues and negative index of the operator. This relation was first formulated in the work of in the recent work of Dmitry Pilinovsky for the system of coupled and LS equations. And X is not in three dimensions, but in real dimensions. But in his work, he used matrix analysis and Sylvester inertia law. Here, we used different techniques. We orthogonalized to the eigenvectors of the adjoint operator. It's convenient to rewrite our spectral problem in an equivalent way. We can write it as sigma 1 h u equals to zu, where sigma 1 is a first Pauli matrix which just flips the vector function. And what we did, we just diagonalized our energy operator. Because originally our energy operator had off-diagonal elements, but we diagonalized the energy operator by adding and subtracting the equations in the spectral problem. So in the new formulation, our energy operator is a pair of Schrödinger operators N plus and L minus, with potentials F plus minus G. There is a nice orthogonality relations, relation between the eigenvectors of this operator. Suppose Zi is the eigenvalue and correspondent eigenvector is Ui, Wi. And Zj is the eigenvalue and correspondent eigenvector is Uj, Wj. And Zi is not equal to plus minus Zj complex conjugate, because here we have really four eigenvalues. Then we have skew orthogonality for the components of the eigenvectors. Ui orthogonal to Wj, and Uj is orthogonal to Wi. So we have orthogonality if we include in the inner product Pauli matrix sigma 1. Ui is orthogonal to Wj, and Uj is orthogonal to W. Skew orthogonality. So we go to the constraint subspace when we orthogonalize to the eigenvectors of the adjoint operator for the same eigenvalues. And in the old setup, we had eigenvectors of the adjoint operator are obtained from the Cj's eigenvectors of the original operator by multiplication by sigma 3. And in the new formulation, we have that eigenvectors of the adjoint operator are obtained from Uj, original eigenvectors, by multiplication by sigma 1. Matrix which just flips the components of the eigenvector. And then we obtain the constraint subspace. And now we need to determine how much the negative index of the energy operator changes if we go to this constraint subspace. So if you have a simple real eigenvalue and eigenvector u0, w0, then the adjoint operator has the same eigenvalue with flipped components, w0, u0. And we orthogonalize to such an eigenvector. And if we have purely imaginary simple eigenvalue, then the eigenvector will be u real, I, w imaginary. And again, the adjoint operator has the same eigenvalue and flipped eigenvector. But if we have a complex eigenvalue, then the situation is slightly different. eigenvector has real and imaginary part. The adjoint operator has flipped eigenvector and we orthogonalize to both real and imaginary. Then we prove a general statement. How the negative index of the problem changes if we go to the constraint subspace. So if we have a self-adjoint operator on the subspace of L2 with finite negative index and empty kernel and positive and essential spectrum, and we have a constraint subspace with n constraints Vj, linearly independent, then the negative eigenvalues will be given by the problem Lv equals to mu v minus sum j from 1 to n mu j Vj. So this problem we obtain if you look for the extrema of the quadratic form of the operator L with fixed L2 norm of v, and v, vj are fixed quantities, and nu j are just Lagrange multiplier. So this is the constrained eigenvalue problem. We introduce the auxiliary matrix A of mu with components vi, mu minus L to the power minus 1, vj. Matrix is defined when mu is not in the spectrum of L, so that mu minus L to the power minus 1 can be inverted. So suppose P eigenvalues of this matrix A when mu is equal to 0 are non-negative. So then we have precise expression for the reduction of the negative index. So negative index in the constraint subspace is equal to the negative index on the original subspace X minus P, where P is the number of non-negative eigenvalues for this auxiliary matrix A of mu. And this method can be used in a variety of problems. I would like to say that there were works like that, like Grilaki, Shatai, and Strauss. So, for example, there was a physics paper of Vahitov and Kolokolov, in which they had one constraint. But here, in this present work, we study L arbitrary self-adjoint operator. We don't use the explicit form. We use spectral calculus. This is the arbitrary self-adjoint operator. And we have n constraints, arbitrary number of constraints. Not one, not two, but just arbitrary number of constraints. So here I present the proof of the case when we have only one constraint. But if there aren't n constraints, the ideas are the same, just a bit more technical. So if we have only one constraint, v constraining function, then our function f of mu, we have not a matrix, but just a function f of mu, which is just v constraining, mu minus L to the power minus 1, v constraining, which is nothing but 1 over nu Lagrange multiplier, v constraining times. And we are interested in the zeros of this constraining function because we solve the constrained eigenvalue problem. And if for this mu, f of mu is 0, then v will be orthogonal to v constraining. So we get a constrained eigenvalue and eigenfunction. So f of mu can be written a very nice way if we write spectral decomposition for the operator mu minus L to the power minus 1. V constraining d lambda, V constraining over mu minus lambda, where d lambda are spectral projections for the operator L. And mu 1 is the lowest eigenvalue of the operator L. By direct computation, we show that f prime of mu is always negative. So function f of mu is always decreasing whenever defined. As I said, our function is defined for mu not in the spectrum of L. So whenever function f of mu is defined, it's decreasing. So our operator L has discrete negative spectrum, eigenvalues are mu k, and we want to investigate the behavior of our function f of mu in the neighborhood of the eigenvalue mu k of the operator L. So we know that function is decreasing whenever defined, but near the eigenvalue, we want to show that there are two types of behavior. Sometimes it's regular, sometimes it's singular. So for the eigenvalue mu k, we have eigenfunctions ukj, set of eigenfunctions, and negative index of the operator L on x is just sum of mu k's, where mu k is degeneracy of this eigenvalue of the operator. So n is the negative index of the operator L on the subspace x. We wrote our function f of mu through the spectral decomposition of the operator L in the following way. And we want to extract the behavior near the eigenvalue mu k. So pk is the spectral projection onto this subspace related to this eigenvalue mu k. So we extracted the behavior near mu k, and everything rest, it's easy to show that it's regular. So f of mu k plus epsilon, behavior function f of mu on the right of the eigenvalue mu k is just given by projection to the subspace of our constraining function. And on the left, it's also very similar, but with a minus sign. So these remaining terms are very easy to show that they are bounded near as we approach the eigenvalue mk. But first terms may have singularities. As epsilon goes to zero, they can blow up or down. So there are two cases. First case is when all eigenfunctions ukj of our operator L belong to the constrained subspace. So ukj is orthogonal to the constraining function. So in this case, since v constraining and ukj are orthogonal for all of these functions, first terms here will vanish, which may contain singularity, 1 over epsilon. And in this case, f of mu can be continuously extended for across the eigenvalue. So f of mu was defined everywhere outside the eigenvalues, but if all the eigenfunctions ukj belong to constrained subspace, then we extend function f of mu continuously across eigenvalue mk. And second and last case is when there exists one of the eigenfunctions corresponding to this eigenvalue of the operator L, which does not belong to the constrained subspace. Then we can make the rest of the eigenfunctions corresponding to the same eigenvalue belong to the constrained subspace by Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization. And behavior of our function f of mu will be like that. In the product of v constraining and uks, our eigenfunction, absolute value squared over epsilon plus bounded terms. And on the left, we have behaviors v constraining times eigenfunction uks in the product absolute value squared over epsilon. So as you can see, then we have blow up from the right, and we go to minus infinity from the left. So in this case, when one of the eigenfunctions does not belong to the constrained subspace and the rest belong, we have blow up from the right and blow to minus infinity from the left. So we have a vertical asymptote at this point, mu k. So now we have a better picture for the behavior of our function f of mu, which describes everything. So suppose we have k vertical asymptotes like that. At eigenvalues mu I1, mu I2, mu ik. So we have k asymptotes. If we have an asymptote, this means that one of the eigenfunctions is not in the constraint subspace. So we have k eigenfunctions do not belong to the x constraint. But the rest of the eigenfunctions corresponding to negative eigenvalues n minus k belong to our constraint subspace. N is the negative index. It's very easy to show that at minus infinity function tends to zero and approaches zero from below. Then it remains negative because it's always monotonically decreasing, and at the first asymptote it goes to minus infinity. So let's draw the picture describing the behavior function f of mu. At minus infinity it goes to zero, then goes monotonically to minus infinity at the first asymptote. At the first asymptote goes to plus infinity and then again decays. So suppose we have two eigenvalues mu I L and mu I L plus 1, where we have asymptotes. Function goes from plus infinity monotonically decreasing to minus infinity. Therefore, it has precisely 1, 0. So on this interval between these two asymptotes, function has 1, 0 at the point mu L star. We solve our constrained Schrödinger equation, eigenvalue equation, for mu equal to mu L star, 0 over the function f of mu. And since f at this point is zero, then this solution UL star will be orthogonal to the constraint constraining function. So this mu UL star will be a constrained negative eigenvalue, and UL star is a corresponding eigenfunction. Its L2 norm is finite, which is very easy to show. So here, this asymptote, we had one function not on the constraint subspace. That's why the asymptote appeared. But we got an extra eigenvalue, one eigenfunction, which lies in the constraint subspace. So then the remaining question is to determine what happens between the last asymptote and zero. So on the interval between the last asymptote and zero, if f at zero is non-negative, then f of mu is monotonically decreasing and approaches this point, non-negative point at zero. Therefore, function has no zeros. But if f at zero is negative, then function goes from plus infinity to its negative value at zero. And therefore, it will definitely have one zero on the interval between the last asymptote and zero. So then we again obtain a constraint eigenvalue and eigenfunction if f at zero is negative. So let's compute the negative index in the constraint subspace. So if f at zero is non-negative, then negative index of the operator L in the constraint subspace will be the following. We had k asymptotes, but n minus k eigenfunctions belong to the constraint subspace. And then we need to add number of zeros of that type. If f at zero is non-negative, then we had k asymptotes and only k minus 1 zeros between them. At k minus 1, we obtained that negative index was reduced by 1. N is the original negative index. So negative index is reduced by 1 if f at 0 is non-negative. And on the other hand, if f at 0 is negative, we obtain additional 0 here. So negative index in the constraint subspaces n minus k, eigenfunctions belong to the constraint subspace, plus we need to add the number of zeros when f at 0 is negative. Between asymptotes, we had k minus 1 zeros plus additional 0 between the last asymptote and 0. So we add k, n minus k plus k, which is nothing but n. So if f at 0 is negative, then the negative index does not change. This is the proof when we had only one constraint, and if we had n constraints, vj from 1 to n linearly independent, then we consider not a scalar function f, but matrix, which elements are quadratic forms of the iterator mu minus l minus 1, computed on vi vj. And by the same method, but slightly more technical, we show that, again, behavior at 0 very much matters. If this matrix f at mu, when mu equals to 0, has spin on negative eigenvalues, then negative index of the problem will be reduced by p. So this is a general statement which we can apply to the variety of problems, and in particular we can apply it to the to our energy operator H, which is a pair of L plus and L minus Schrödinger operators. So in our setup we obtain our energy operator is a pair of operators n plus and l minus, and we want to apply this theorem to our energy operator. So for l plus and l minus, we obtain constrained eigenvalue equations when we orthogonalize to the eigenfunctions of the adjoint operator, and then we construct our matrices A plus of mu for l plus and l A minus of mu for L minus. We construct our matrices and A plus and A minus, and want to show how much the negative index for the operators changes. It turns out that A plus at 0 and A minus at 0 can be decomposed into diagonal blocks by the orthogonality relations, because eigenfunctions, eigenvectors of our linearized operator are skew orthogonal. So, due to the orthogonality relations, A plus at 0 and A minus at 0 will be decomposed into diagonal blocks, and of diagonal elements are 0. And there are three cases. First, we have a real eigenvalue, then the block will consist of only one element. Minus 1 over Z0 squared, half of the energy related to this eigenvalue. So, and if this eigenvalue is of negative energy, then this is half of the energy, with minus will be positive, and both A plus at 0 and A minus at 0 will have each one positive eigenvalue. In the case, we have real eigenvalues with negative energy. And therefore, when we orthogonalize, negative index will be reduced by 2 n real with negative energy. But if the if the energy was positive, then with minus sign, we get a negative eigenvalue both for A plus and A minus. And this doesn't influence anything. If we had a purely imaginary eigenvalue, then the diagonal entries for A plus at 0 and A minus at 0 will be also proportional to half of the energy, but they will be of opposite signs. And if A plus at 0 is positive, then A minus at 0 is negative, or the other way around. So for the purely imaginary eigenvalue, it will contribute to one positive eigenvalue for A plus at 0 or and one negative eigenvalue for a minus zero, the other way around. And therefore, the negative index will be reduced by number of such imaginary eigenvalues. And the last case is that when we have a complex eigenvalue, then we need to orthogonalize to both real and imaginary part of the eigenvector, and we get not a single entry, but 2x2 block. 2x2 block, which are both equal for a plus and a minus. We show that the determinant of this 2x2 block is negative, therefore this block has one positive and one negative eigenvalue. Negative index is reduced by the number of positive eigenvalues for matrices at zero. Therefore, will be reduced by two number of such complex eigenvalues. And then finally, we obtain the formula for the reduction of the negative index of our energy operator. So negative index on the continuous spectrum, when we orthogonalized all the eigenvectors corresponding to bound states, is negative index when we orthogonalize to the kernel, which is known by Grelacki, Chatay, and Strauss theorem, minus two number of real eigenvalues with negative energy, minus number of imaginary eigenvalues, minus two number of complex eigenvalues. And since operator of energy is strictly positive on the essential spectrum, which was proved by Scipio Cucani using wave operators, this is zero, then we obtain formula connecting negative index of the operator H and distribution of eigenvalues. So this formula shows that imaginary complex and real eigenvalues with negative energy, all of them contribute to the negative index of the energy operator. And the case when we have real eigenvalues with zero energy is being investigated. Actually, for the reduction of negative index, we have L. Operator L is self-adjoint with positive continuous spectrum, finite negative index. In the theorem, we require that kernel is empty, but it can be generalized to the non-empty kernel because we invert L minus, we find L minus 1. Actually our function f at 0 was, for example, we considered finite at 0, f of mu. Well, f at 0 can be either non-negative or negative, but everything will be the same if it goes to minus infinity here, because it crosses the axis and has one more zero. J is a third Pauli matrix. Yeah. One minus one. Yes, yes. And as I said, there are several ways to write this non-self-adjoint operators. We add and subtract equations, and we get not sigma 3, but sigma 1 times h, where sigma 1 just flips the vector function. And h is the...